And now, ladies and gentlemen, it's time for the Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Each week, Ray spotlights in-depth interviews with legendary and up-and-coming authors and music artists. Ray also features the movers and the shakers of the music and publishing industries and suggests important methods for getting the most out of your public relations and marketing needs. Please welcome music journalist, author, and entrepreneur, Ray Shasho.
Hello again, everyone. I'm Ray Shasho, broadcasting from BBS Radio. And welcome to the show where we spotlight legendary and up-and-coming music artists and authors. Brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call us today at 941-877-1552. Or visit www.publicityworksagency.com. Remember, we shine only when we make you shine. Before the Lights Go Out is longtime Alice Cooper, Lou Reed guitarist Steve Hunter's latest solo album. The cover art and title make a statement about his failing eyesight, but don't make the mistake of thinking this is a quiet wave goodbye. As soon as you put on the first track, you will know that this is more like a blues rock declaration of independence. There are sexy grooves, luscious guitar tones, and melodies galore. As with all Hunter's releases, there is some diversity in sound imagery, not least of which is Tienes Mi Corazón, where alongside his nylon string improvisation comes the sound of his own heart. And listen out for Joe Satriani adding his fire to the heat of Mojo Man. Also joining Steve on a couple of tracks are two great bass players. Eric Scott can be heard on Mojo Man. Eric is also an Alice Cooper alumni. On Under the Bodhi Tree is Andy Stoller. Steve and Andy toured together with Tracy Chapman during the Telling Stories album period. Most recently, Andy has been touring with Ann Wilson of Heart. Says Steve, the album was a real joy for me on many levels. A big part of the inspiration and motivation that kept me going was from all the people out there who had faith in me and encouraged me through the entire process with their donations and comments. It was really a wonderful experience having you all be a part of it. It's my deepest hope and desire that you all enjoy the music on this album as much as I enjoyed making it. Thank you and God bless. Steve Hunter is his own man. He has been around the block with a 45-year career, from his 1973 solos on Alice Cooper's Billion Dollar Babies album, his legendary acoustic work on Peter Gabriel's Salisbury Hill, his intro to Lou Reed's Sweet Jane, and his searing opening solos on Aerosmith's version A Train Kept A-Rollin'. Most recently, he can be heard on Alice Cooper's 2017 album, Paranormal, making his 9th Cooper album appearance. The Deacon is not done yet, but his life is evolving. He has challenges playing live now, but his honed skill, tone, power, and soul is dished up on this hot plate of guitar-driven instrumental tastiness. You can purchase Before the Lights Go Out by Steve Hunter today at Amazon.com. Please welcome legendary guitarist and the Deacon of Rock, Steve Hunter, to the Ray Shasho Show. Hello, Steve.
Hi, Ray. How are you?
I'm doing fine. How about yourself? How are things out in Arizona?
Oh, it's nice, actually. This time of year is probably one of the best times of the year out here in Arizona.
It's not too hot,
and it's not, you know, it's really beautiful, very sunny, and yeah, it's great.
What part of Arizona are you in?
Well, we're in a small town right outside Phoenix called Maricopa.
Okay.
It's about 25 minutes or so kind of southwest of Phoenix. It's a nice little community out in the desert.
Out in the desert, yeah.
Yeah.
I've been to Tucson, and the thing I noticed more than anything was all the cactus. I mean, it was incredible. If nobody's been to Arizona, I've never seen so many cactus in all my life.
Yeah, this is cactus heaven out here. That's true.
So you got the nickname the Deacon as a joke, right? Between you and the legendary Bob Ezrin, and then
it pretty much was a joke. Yeah, he. This is in the early days. I didn't have a place to live, so when I wasn't in the studio somewhere, I would go back home live with my parents, and then I would usually be off again. And I was home at my parents' house, and Bob called and said he had a project for me to come up to Toronto, where we did a lot of the work. We did a ton of work in Toronto with Peter Gabriel's album and right. Alice Cooper albums and stuff. And he did kind of tongue-in-cheek asked me, you're not drinking or doing drugs now, are you? Because it had been a little while since we had worked together. Uh-huh. And I said, oh, no, I'm still the deacon of rock and roll. It was a joke. Mm-hmm. And then it just sort of stuck. There have been sessions that I had done where there were more than one Steve, and so it was easier just to call me the deacon, you know. So it stuck. And so now it's been with me for like about 40 years. So, but that's all right. I like it. It's just fun. It's a fun nickname. You know?
Yeah, I like you too. I think Dr. John kept calling you that when you were playing with him, right?
Yeah, that's all he calls me. I saw him at the Hall of Fame show, and I said, hey, well, his name is Mac Remnack,
right.
And
I
call him Mac. And I said, hey, Mac, it's Steve Hunter. I said, hey, Deacon, how you doing? So I think that's all he knows me by, really, is my nickname.
That's funny. I interviewed Mac, and it was one of the toughest interviews to, understand. He's got that heavy accent, kind of his own language,
which is, you know, which I love. It's a little bit of Cajun. There's a little bit of stuff in there. It's wonderful. It's very rich, cultured language, isn't it?
It sure is. I had to go back like, 10, 20 times to really listen to the interview to figure out what he was saying, you know. But
yeah, but I tell you, after working with him a couple of days, I got used to it. I totally understood him. I just totally got used to it. You know, it was great.
That's pretty cool. Who are some of your early musical heroes? I know you started playing guitars very early, like around 8 years old or so, right?
Yeah, I was 8 years old when I started on lap steel. My father played a little bit of guitar, and I was asked if I wanted to play an instrument, and I said, yeah. And he said, it's really funny, drummers love this story, because my dad said, well, what instrument would you like to play? And I said, drums. And dad said, no, it's got to be music. drummers love that story. I mean, I knew what he meant. He meant musical notes, you know.
Right. But,
And then so my second choice, oddly enough, was guitar. And I was only eight, so I really didn't know guitar was a guitar, you know. And my dad played a little bit of lap steel, so he found a teacher that taught lap steel, and I started taking lessons on lap steel. I took for about 5 years. So one of my heroes was a marvelous, wonderful lap steel player called Jerry Bird.
Mm-hmm.
He's sort of like, I don't know how to describe him, really. He was like playing beautiful things on lap steel that sounded like pedal steel before pedal steel was invented, you know?
Right.
Just a superb touch. I got to see him once live when I was about nine or ten, and he just... For a kid, he was like, oh, my God, this guy's ridiculous. You know, he was like such a beautiful musician. And then there was another guy that that Jerry Bird thought was cool, a Hawaiian guy named Saul Hoopy,
mm-hmm.
who was kind of the Eddie Van Halen of Hawaiian guitar. It's the best way to describe him. He used to do all these really weird, wonderful tricks with and then, of course, there was a guy named Alvino Ray who did a lot mm-hmm. of stuff like that, too. So I was sort of, and then actually... two of my favorites were Santo and Johnny, of course. When Sleepwalk came out, I couldn't believe that there was a lap steel song that was a number one single, you know, and it was instrumental. I was completely blown away by that. So those guys were all my heroes when I was studying lap steel. But then I kind of ran into Chet Atkins, and
right.
Chet Atkins just completely blew me away.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe he could play the stuff he could play on guitar. I just couldn't believe it. And I was so knocked out that it actually pulled me away from lap steel. And I was about 12, and I started playing regular guitar, as I call it, when I was about 12.
Lap steel, how hard is that to play? What's the difference between lap steel, lap guitar, and the pedal lap steel?
Well, right and left-hand techniques are very similar. You still mm-hmm. have a bar, you know, you still use a bar to fret the instrument.
Right.
Pedal steel is far more complicated because you've got pedals that raise strings, certain strings in pitch, and then there are knee levers that lower strings in pitch. So you get this big wide gambit of textures you can get out of a pedal and chordal things and stuff. I mean, Buddy Emmons, one of the greatest, used to play jazz on pedal steel.
Wow,
on incredible. The last two, you really can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because you're limited. Now, Jerry Bird, of course, could make a lyre out of it because he had all these. He must have had, I think, 30 or 40 different tunings,
right,
and different techniques, and he was able to play some jazz on a lap steel. But there are just basically they're the same. They're played the same way.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, a lap steel can have anywhere from 6 to 10 strings. And a pedal steel usually has 10, sometimes 12, depending on how complex you want to be. And, of course, like I say, the harmonic structures you can do with pedal steel are far more complex
right,
than lap
right.
steel.
Now, guys like David Gilmour and Steve Howe, they play, is that called a lap steel guitar, what they're playing as well?
Yeah. David Gilmour's okay. playing lap steel. I've seen him do it on stage and stuff.
Right.
And Steve Howe also, it's lap steel, yeah.
It doesn't look easy to play, in my opinion.
You know, it's not real. It's not as easy as it kind of sounds like it'd be easy because you just have a bar with your left hand. You don't have to do all this fingering stuff. And,
right.
But it's a whole lot more complicated than it initially looks. There's a little more involved. There's a lot of technique stuff involved.
Is it a little bit like slide? I mean, the technique at all?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know,
like
it's very
slide.
Much like slide. The only difference is, of course, your left hand position is different.
Right.
But it's the same thing. It's basically you can play slide guitar stuff on a lap steel.
Yeah, do you still play lap steel guitar once in a
you
while?
You know, or? I do.
Yeah.
I've played lap steel solos on Julian Lennon's album Saltwater.
Right.
I played lap steel on that. I played a lap steel solo, and on my previous album, Manhattan Blues Project, I played some lap steel on there. It's like a George Harrison-y kind of sounding thing. Is what I like about the lap steel. It has a sweeter tone to me. Slide can tend to get a little more grungy, which I like too, but for, you know, for other things. But for really sweet tonal stuff, I really love lap steel. It's just I still have my father's old Supro, mm-hmm. and I use it all the time.
So you played lap steel on Flames at the Dakota, your tribute to John and George?
Yes. Well,
because it does sound like George Harrison.
It was more George Harrison, yeah.
Yeah,
it was more,
yeah.
It was more of a George Harrison-y kind of thing, yeah.
Yeah. And you also played sitar, didn't you, on that track?
No, I don't have a sitar. I wish I did.
It sounded like
I really
it.
Do wish,
yeah.
I really wish I had a sitar, but no, I don't have a sitar, and I haven't even tried to play one.
Oh, you need to get a sitar. I can see you.
I would love
that.
To have one, to be honest with you. I really would. I've always wanted first of all, I think they're absolutely beautiful instruments, and...
Yep.
I was one of those millions of people that just fell in love with Ravi Shankar in the 60s, you know.
Yeah.
When I first heard it, I thought it was the most magnificent thing I'd ever heard in my life. It was, and then I thought, there's no way in God's earth I'm ever going to be able to play one of those things. You know, like, my God, that's just, you know, that's beyond human, that.
You need to take a trip to India, you know.
Oh, I'd love to. That's one of the places I like to visit. I'll have to put that on one of those what they call bucket lists.
On the bucket list, definitely.
Yeah.
Gary Wright. George Harrison gave Gary Wright a sitar, which was pretty cool. He still has it. I talked to Gary on an interview, which was pretty neat. Because him and George
wonderful.
Are pretty close.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he got a present of it from George.
You know, they're so beautiful, I wouldn't mind just sitting in the corner and look at it. You know?
Exactly. I agree with you. I'd like to have one, too.
Yeah, they're beautiful. They're beautiful instruments.
Well, let's see.
And, Ravi Shankar's daughter, Anushka, is not doing too badly.
Yeah, that's right.
I don't know if you've heard her play, but she's really amazing.
You were in the Army, and you got your start in the music business from a guy named John Polar Bear Seltzer. He went on to, he was in Mitch Ryder, and he went on to play with Ted Nugent.
That's right.
He did that famous bass line for Stranglehold, you know, famous guy. So he basically got you started, huh? Brought you into Mitch Ryder?
Yeah, he was playing with Mitch Ryder at the time. Mm-hmm. They were rehearsing doing some pre-production on an album. Of course, I didn't know anything about this. John Sauter I knew for a long, long, long time in Decatur. Yep. We played in bands together, and he played in other bands, and I think he was doing most of his, I think he was living in Champaign at the time, but I did see him a lot, and we were pretty good friends. And he called me one day, and he said, listen, you know, I'm playing with Mitch Ryder right now, and they're looking for guitar players, and they're auditioning guitar players, and they haven't found anybody yet. You ought to come up here and give it a shot. So I said, okay, and I grabbed my guitar, and I think I had to drive about 8 hours from Decatur to Detroit.
Wow.
And the next day, I plugged into a Marshall for the very first time. It's the first time I'd seen one in person, you know, and it sounded so good that I didn't really care whether I got the gig or not. I just wanted to, I loved to play through the Marshall so much, it really didn't matter whether I got the gig. But
that's funny.
As it turns out, it was wonderful. Johnny B's an incredible drummer, and, you know, Johnny Sauter is a great bass player. So we just did this sort of trio thing with Mitch singing, and we did things like Cream tunes, because I didn't know any of their tunes. So we just did jammed on Cream tunes, and it just sounded fabulous. So I got the gig, and that's where I met Bob Ezrin. It's the first album I ever did. The first recorded album was the Detroit with featuring Mitch Ryder album. And that's where I met Bob, of course, and then Bob and I did millions of things together.
Yeah, you and Bob go way back, man. I mean, well, every album, everything you ever did was with Bob, pretty much.
Yeah, that was 1971 when I met him.
Yeah. Yeah, he's a legend. Yeah, we don't have too many guys like him anymore.
No, you don't.
Yeah.
That's true.
We don't. Then the dynamic duo of you and Dick Wagner. Wow, you guys were awesome, man. Yeah, I looked at the that guitar duel you did in 1975 on YouTube of you guys.
Yeah.
That was incredible. And you guys actually met in Florida.
Yeah, we did that every night. We did that every night.
Yeah. Every night.
I had this idea it was really funny because in rehearsal, I had this idea. I say, hey, Dick, we ought to make this like a real duel. Like, we ought to look like we're getting mad at each other and almost getting into a big fight while we're playing. And I said, you take your guitar and you just take a swing at me and I'll go down, you know. And so we did that every night. But the thing is, on the first day of rehearsal, I didn't tell him that one of the road crew had given me a blood capsule.
Really?
And, he took a swing at me, and I popped the blood capsule, and he thought he'd really hit me. And it was really funny. He got all...
That's funny.
No, Dick, it's a joke, man. Don't worry. No, you didn't hit me. It's okay. But we used that blood capsule every night, and it was amazing because the first five rows or so in the audience would see that and think that I'd really gotten hit. It was funny.
That's pretty cool. A la Gene Simmons, huh?
Yeah. Well, we did it before him, I have to say. We did it before Gene Simmons did it.
Yeah, there was a few things before Gene Simmons. He claims he did it all, you know.
Yeah.
You guys were awesome together. One thing, I've seen Lou Reed a couple of times not do that intro, that famous intro that you created, and it's just not the same. That, you know, Sweet Jane is all about the intro, in my opinion. And it was so incredible the way you made that into the song.
That, well, you know, yeah, thank you.
That's
yeah.
rock and roll folklore right there.
I mean, it was something that I had been working on for a long, long, long time. I mean, I had worked on it 2 or 3 years kind of messing around with it. And, I just, for the longest time, I just thought, well, okay, this is kind of fun to play, but I don't know if I'm ever going to be able to really use it.
Yeah.
And it just turned out that we were able to fit it in. Actually, in Europe, we played it before Vicious.
Mm-hmm.
It just so happened that it was the same relative key. We Vicious is in E minor, and then Sweet Jane is in E major. So the ending chord of my intro was a five chord of each one of those keys. So it just happened to work on both of them. But it just, with that band, it just came to life. That band played it really well. What I did was I wrote the structure, and then we sort of, the guys in the band all kind of improvised their part each night,
right.
So we kept it kind of fresh. And I never played the same thing twice, you know, every night. It was always improvised over a structure,
yep.
Which is kind of like the old jazz thinking, you know,
exactly.
You develop a structure and then you improvise over that.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
That, you know, that's one of my favorite tunes is definitely Sweet Jane. And, you know, I get disappointed when I see Lou, some of his performances didn't have that intro in it. He just got into it, and he played his guitar, you know, just getting into it.
Well, you know, I
got
to say, I understand that, and I think that's awesome, and it's very cool. But I got to say, when we did the Berlin tour, the last Berlin tour before Lou passed away, we did Sweet Jane a little closer to Velvet Underground.
Right.
And I got to tell you, I really liked it.
Really?
You know,
really?
It was like, wow, this is pretty cool the way this is, you know, this is, it was a whole different sort of vibe to it, and it was cool. I actually really enjoyed playing it that way. So it was like both ways are cool to me now, you know what I mean?
And, yeah.
I hadn't really had a chance to play it that way before, and to play it that way with Lou, it's on the video, the Berlin Live video.
Right.
It was really, I really enjoyed it, I have to say.
What was it like working with Lou?
Well, it's great. The funny thing is, in the 70s, 73, 74, something like that, he was a pretty quiet guy. He never said much, and I was too. So we never really talked much in those days. But when I got the call to do the Berlin thing live, which I was very excited about, I wasn't sure how this was going to be. We hadn't seen each other for, God, years, 30 years or something, and 40 years, really.
Jeez.
And it was so funny. When we sort of looked at each other and didn't know quite how to act, and we gave each other a hug, and from that moment on, we were like brothers. It's like old brothers. I hadn't seen each other, and he was funny. It was really wonderful. I mean, I really enjoyed working with him and touring with him and stuff, and he was great to hang with, which I'd never done before.
Yeah.
So it was great.
I hear all good stories about Lou. I think I talked to Niels Lofgren, who did some stuff with Lou as well, and, you know, it's all good. You know, I haven't heard anything bad about Lou at all.
No.
You know,
he's
great guy.
A cool guy. He was a cool guy, man.
Yeah. You were asked to do the intro, and I'm thinking another Bob Ezrin thing to do. Train Kept a Rollin'. I think he wasn't he in another studio or something, and they asked you to do it, the intro. To...
yeah, boy, you don't know how many bloody times I've told this story.
I can believe it.
It's all over the internet. It's all everywhere. Okay,
well,
I'll tell it one more time, and then I'm not going to tell it ever again.
We'll put it to sleep.
I was sitting in the lobby at the record plant. I had done some work. Bob Ezrin and I were in Studio A, starting to get to, I don't know who we were working on. I don't know if it was Alice or Lou or who it was, but Bob had to do an edit, and in those days you cut 2-inch tape, and you had to be really careful, and it's very, very difficult. So I usually left him alone so he could concentrate, pay attention to what he's doing. So I was out in the lobby having cigarettes back when I used to smoke. And Studio C was right across from the lobby from where I was sitting. It's a little tiny lobby, you know. And Jack Douglas poked his head out the door, and he saw me there, and he said, "Do you feel like playing?" And I said, "Well, yeah, Bob's doing an edit. I'd rather play than just sit here." So he said, "Well, let me go ask Bob." So he went in the studio and asked Bob. Bob said, "Yes, fine." And then he grabbed an old Tweed Twin out of the studio that we've used before. It's a great amp. And went into Studio C. I plugged in. I played one pass, and Jack said, "Well, you're kind of stepping on the vocal." And I said, "Oh, I'm sorry. Well, I didn't hear the vocal. It wasn't in the headphones." And so he turned the head. I said, "Oh, okay. I see it. The vocal's not in the headphones." Turned the headphones up so I could hear the vocal, and then I did another pass, and that was it. And he said, "Yeah, sounds great. Thanks a lot."
You did it one take. Yeah, one take.
Well, it was two takes, really.
Oh, two takes.
I went by it twice, and the first time it's just I didn't know where the vocal was because I couldn't hear it, so I just kind of played. Besides that, it takes me a little while to kind of warm up, so I was just thinking I'll just go to play through everything and just warm up, get my fingers warmed up. And then the second take, he said, "No, just play, man. So it sounds great," and that was the take he kept. So
that's amazing. That's a great story, though.
Go figure.
Yeah, go figure. Yeah, the rest is history. You know, I wanted to tell the audience about Train Kept a Rollin'. The original version was done by Tiny Bradshaw. That was done in 1951. Johnny Burnett did a rockabilly version. I think it was in 1956. Yep. And I'm not sure who the guitar player was. It Paul Burleson or Grady Martin that was actually on that track? Do you know?
That I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. My guess is Grady, but I'm not sure.
They say it's Grady. I think it is Grady.
Yeah.
Now, which version did, do you know any idea which version Aerosmith liked the best? I'm thinking the rockabilly version, but.
Well, I don't know. The version they actually took from was Jeff Beck's version from the Yardbirds.
Oh, was it the Yardbirds version?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because that Johnny Burnett version was awesome. It was incredible.
I thought so, too. It was great. Yeah. I've seen it on YouTube a couple times.
Alice Cooper had Glenn Buxton, Michael Bruce on guitars, yet you and Dick were on a lot of the tracks. Why do you think that is? Why did Alice want you guys on it when they had good guitar players at the time?
Well, on Billion Dollar Babies, we weren't really on that many tracks. I'm not sure how many Dick played on because I wasn't there when he did it. You know, I played five or six solos, I think. But there were other guitar players. Rick Derringer was on. I think, in essence, that album, I think Bob was looking for, Bob and I think everybody was kind of looking for a lot of diversity in sound.
Right.
To widen the scope of the album a little, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was it, because I know those guys. Those guys were all really, they're all good friends of mine, still are.
Right.
And they could play, they played great. I saw them right after they did that album on tour, and they were awesome. That band was really an awesome live band.
Yep.
So I just think they were looking for as much diversity on that album as they could possibly get. And there were a lot of guitar players, there were singers, you know. So I think that's all it was. I think it was that simple. Just it was a creative, artistic decision.
Yeah, Alice stole Lou Reed's guitarists. That's what he did.
Well, I don't know. No, I don't think so, because I think Lou was ready to move on anyway. He wanted to move on to something else.
Mm-hmm.
I think a lot of this stuff, everybody wants to kind of read into it, but in actual fact, a lot of times it's just evolution, you know.
It's just evolution, right.
Okay, Lou probably thought, okay, I did that, now I want to try this, you know.
Exactly.
He did that a lot, and one of the reasons why I liked him and respected him so much was that he was like that. That he would, okay, I've done that, I want to try something new.
Right, and he did.
It kept all of his songs fresh.
Yep. I agree with you. Alice always had great guitar players on every album, you know.
Yeah, he's had a lot of great musicians. He's always been surrounded by really, really good players. There's good, great drummers, bass players, and everything. You know, it's very cool. And as a musician myself, playing with him is a blast. Mm-hmm. You know, playing all those great songs. You know, it's really a blast. It's a lot of fun playing with him on stage. So.
Were you on the Welcome to My Nightmare tour, the first one?
Yeah, 75.
You were on that tour, yeah. So I did see you, because I went to that tour, and I saw you guys at the Cap Center in D.C. with Rory Buchanan and the James Gang. And
Rory Buchanan was brilliant that night.
Oh, my God, he was incredible.
Yeah, I saw him.
Tommy Bolin was in the James Gang, I believe, too, which was cool, because he's a great guitar player. But I saw Roy Buchanan that night break a string in the middle of an intense guitar solo, and he just jammed like nothing else, nothing happened.
Yeah.
You know, has that happened to you where you break a string or two and just, you know, how do you deal with that?
Well, if it doesn't have a whammy bar on it, you just keep playing.
Yeah.
If it's got a whammy bar on it, you're pretty much messed up, because the guitar will just go warpedly out of tune, you know.
Right.
And there's not a whole lot you can do. You can sort of try to dance around it, but it's not easy. Anything with a stop tailpiece or a stud tailpiece, if you break a string and the guitar stays in tune, you can just keep playing.
You can't keep playing with it.
Yeah. Eric Clapton did that. There's a couple times, I think, there's been some live videos of Clapton doing that where he's broken a couple of strings and just kept right on playing.
That's crazy.
Yep.
Yeah, I saw Mick Ronson did it on the Midnight Special with David Bowie. And I saw him break a string, and he just kept on going. I think they were playing Space Oddity.
Yeah.
You said you became a versatile guitar player, but would rather have been more like Eddie Van Halen, who mastered a particular style. But I admire you more because you can do anything.
Well, you know, it's a two-edged sword, really, because Eddie Van Halen, the brilliance of what he did was he honed in on a style and just completely nailed it and perfected it and made it completely his own. So when you hear Eddie Van Halen, you know it's Eddie Van Halen. And it's made him very, very, very successful. And whereas with me, it the versatility kind of thing, which I it's just the way I am. You know, I like a lot of different kinds of music.
Sure.
So I might get bored with one kind of music, and then I move on to another one, and then I can go back to the one that bored me the first time. You know what I mean?
Right.
So,
yep.
And I like so many styles of guitar that I like to explore all those, you know. But having said that sometimes it's like, well, what is he? Is he an acoustic player? Is he? People want to know if you're in a certain, you know, you're in a certain genre or you're in a certain style. They want to know that. You know, they want to know that to recognize you. And it's really funny because a lot of the stuff, I did a lot of acoustic stuff that ended up on records, you know, like Salisbury Hill, but also You and Me and I Never Cry with Alice Cooper. And so I played acoustic guitar on those. You know, it's really weird. But I got this reputation of being Alice Cooper's guitar player. And sometimes that pigeonholes you someplace and you can't get out of it. You know, I thought trying to be as versatile as I could would keep me busy. But unfortunately, that doesn't always work. Mm-hmm. You know, it does and it doesn't. There's been times when that's come in so handy. And then there's been other times where I've been sitting waiting for the phone to ring. You know?
Yeah.
So it's a two-edged sword.
But if people are looking for session work, they're going to call you. They're not going to call Eddie Van Halen, right? Pretty much.
Well, no, that just, I think it depends. You know, I'm not a particularly good reader. And, of course, now with my eyes, I'm not a reader because I can't really see the page.
It's got to make things tough, yeah.
But when I think of session guys, I think of guys like Timmy Pierce and Michael Landau. And Michael Landau is one of the most incredible readers I've ever seen. I've been in the studio with him. And, you know, he can read his way through one take, and he's done. You know, he's amazing. Mm. And so is Timmy Pierce. Tim Pierce can do the same thing. Those guys are really brilliant readers. And that really is what gets you in the studio quicker than just versatility.
Yeah.
Versatility is like a really close second to that, but the very first thing is being a brilliant reader.
Yeah, like the Wrecking Crew. Those guys are amazing.
Well, they set the standard.
Yeah.
There's no question about that. They set the standard. And you talk about versatility. Those guys were all over the board.
You know, it's kind of sad in a way that, you know, the public is now sometimes just finding out how important they were. I mean, fellow musicians knew, but the public didn't know that how many albums those guys were really on.
Oh, it's ridiculous.
You know? It is ridiculous.
And some of your favorite bands, you know.
The Beach Boys.
Well, they did a lot of Beach Boys stuff, and they did a lot of Paul Revere Radio stuff. And,
yep.
I mean, on and on and on and on. Sonny and Cher stuff, and on and on and on. They just
Glenn
did
Campbell.
So many.
Yeah.
And a lot of Temptations and a lot of soul stuff.
Crazy. It's crazy.
They just could play anything, and they could play it really well, you know.
Yep. Well, I think you could do that, too.
Well, you know what? I try. I try to do that because I enjoy that, too. I enjoy...
Yeah.
Maybe I was a little late. I mean, I think I would have enjoyed being in with the Wrecking Crew because I love those guys. And it would have been nice if I could have made it in there with those guys, you know.
Did you, growing up, did you like the Ventures?
I loved the Ventures. I think I had about 20 of their albums at one point. Yeah. No, I loved them. They were great.
Those guys taught so many, you know, legendary artists in the beginning, you know.
That's how you learn. I learned by the Ventures and Duane Eddy.
And Duane Eddy, that's
another
right.
One that was,
yeah.
I couldn't believe there's instrumental guitar music. See, that's what's gotten me off on doing these solo CDs of mine now, is I've always been enamored by solo guitar music.
Right.
And I still keep thinking there's a solo guitar single out there, you know, a guitar instrumental single. Maybe it might be too late for that, but, you know, Duane Eddy had number one hits. Santo and Johnny Sleepwalk was a number one hit.
Mm-hmm.
And They're there. They were there for a while, and I keep thinking maybe if I just keep trying, maybe I'll write one. You know, and somebody will say, "Yeah, that's great," and you know, maybe it'll be a top 10. I don't know.
Why not?
But I've always thought there's one out there, and I've always been completely enamored by guitar instrumental music. I think Jeff Beck's the same thing. I think he heard it and said, "You know, I love this is what I want to do. I just want to make guitar music," and I think it's great.
I want to talk about Before the Lights Go Out. I'll give it 5 stars, if that's okay. I mean,
that's wonderful. Thank you very much.
It's awesome, man. I love your music. Most of it, of course, is instrumental. Instead of your wife, I guess, sang on the last track. And then there was some chanting on under the Bodhi tree.
Yep.
Yeah, that song was cool.
That chanting was a sample.
Okay.
I found it on a sound effects website.
Really?
And it's a live recording. It's a live recording of real Buddhist monks chanting in a garden.
I love it.
So it's the real deal. It's not that.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty cool. I found it and just loved it. Said, you know what? I got to have this on the Bodhi tree.
And to me, it sounds a little bit like Pink Floyd-ish, you know? It's kind of ambient.
David Gilmour and Pink Floyd have been a big influence on me. I love their music. I love their harmonies and their harmonic structures and their chord progressions and stuff. I've always liked the band for many, many, many years, all the way back to Dark Side, you know? And so they're a big influence on me, and I don't even try to hide it.
I'm wanting to pick out things like that too.
I'm
a big Pink Floyd fan as well. Do you know David?
No, I've never met him, and I wish one day that I could.
Yeah,
I really admire his playing.
You guys need to play together. That'd be awesome.
I would love to. That would be a thrill for me.
Yeah, you know, my favorite thing with David's first solo album was incredible.
Yeah, he's got some good solo albums. The last one, On an Island, is beautiful.
Yeah.
I think I've got three of them or something, two or three of them.
Yeah, I love his first one, and then I think the second one's called About Face. That was another good album.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, he's done some good stuff.
Yeah,
but back to the album, I think one of my favorite tunes is Cinderblock. It's kind of an Irish jig, country hoedown type of a track. I love it.
Yeah, it is. It's a bit of a country track. Yeah. It's sort of, I tell you what it is, like it's sort of almost an Appalachian.
Mm-hmm.
Type of
exactly.
mountainy kind of thing,
yeah.
That just developed out of a tuning. The tuning I use is one of Ry Cooder's tunings, and I just was experimenting with it one day, and the whole main line came out, and the song developed from there, and I loved it because I thought, wow, this sounds really Appalachian.
And it does.
Again, though, it's the kind of thing I like, that sort of thing, you know, so. I was really happy to get something like that on the album.
Then you have your beautiful acoustic playing with Tienes Mi Corazón, which, where did you come up with the Spanish title for that?
Well, here's the deal. Karen and I are planning on moving to Spain.
Really?
I thought, you know what, I got to have something on here that's in Spanish. Since we're moving to Spain, I got to have something that we can use a Spanish title on. The song came from the fact that I had to do an ultrasound on my heart. Just a routine thing, just to check everything.
Sure.
And the guy doing the tech doing it had the audio up, and I heard one of my valves opening and closing. And I said, wow, man, that's really cool. You know, I got to record that because I think I could use that. So the next time it came in, he let me record it. And I recorded it. And I wrote a song in that tempo. The tempo is exactly the rate that valve
amazing.
Was opening and closing. I think it's 133 or something.
Huh.
So I wrote a whole song around that. And then when it came to the title, well, I had to have a heart in there somewhere. So Mi Corazón means my heart.
Right.
And so we were looking it up on the phone. We were Googling it and stuff. And it ended up, this phrase popped up, Tienes Mi Corazón, which means you have my heart. And I thought, wow, that's a really, really cool title for this song. So that's how it came to be.
It's a great track. You know, I'm jealous of you going to Spain. My family on my mom's side was from Spain. They're from my grandfather was from Catalunya,
yeah.
You know, which they just won their independence, I guess.
That's what they were trying to do. Yeah,
They won the vote, but they went through a lot of hardship to get it. I mean,
they sure did. Yeah,
they were brutalized.
Yeah. Well, we want to go there because Karen's parents live there, and she'd like to spend some time with them. You know,
sure.
She was here for a little over 10 years in America, so she had moved over. And it took her quite a ways away from her children and her parents. And we started thinking, well, maybe it's time we moved over there. You know,
mm-hmm.
you had
sure.
10 years here. I'll do 10 years over there. Let's just move over there. I'm fine with it. You know, I'm totally mm-hmm. fine with it. In fact, I'm ready to go, you know. we went to Calpe,
uh-huh.
where her parents live, and it's absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
So I didn't want to leave. We were there for 10 days, and I didn't want to leave. And there's been many places I've been in 10 days and I'm ready to leave, but this place I did not want to leave, and so I pretty much made up my mind after about the third day that I could live here.
Yeah.
So that's where we're headed.
I'd love to move to Spain if I can get my wife to do it.
Yeah.
That's the hard part.
Yeah. But I'd
move in a heartbeat. I'm like you. It's a beautiful country.
It's beautiful. Yeah, it really.
Yeah.
Is. Yeah.
Oh, back to the album. On the Edge of Uncertainty is another really cool track, great slide.
Thank you.
I had a comment here. Let's see, it is a little bit Jeff Beckish.
I heard a little bit.
Jeff Beckish in it. Mojo Man, to me, another awesome tune. I kind of heard Buddy Miles Them Changes riff on that.
It's got a little more Hendrix stuff in it.
Exactly, and Stevie Ray Vaughan too. A little bit of that, you know.
Little Stevie Ray.
Stevie Ray.
Yeah.
And awesome lead with the wah-wah on that track.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yep. Again, Cinderblock was my favorite. Soft Tail Deuce.
Yeah. You know,
with the motorcycle sound effects at the end. To talk about that tune.
Well, that tune came about. Actually, I wrote it. I wrote the basic part of the song, I don't know, 10 years ago. It's an old song. But I hadn't really developed it. I just had the melody, and I hadn't quite developed the whole song yet. So I was going through some of my old song ideas when I was working on the album, and I found that, and I thought, you know, I've always liked this. I might as well sit down here and try to flesh it out and get it all done. And so I worked on it some more and got it all done and got it to where I liked it. I had originally just called it Soft Tail, but then I had heard that Harley-Davidson built one of their models was a Soft Tail Deuce,
mm-hmm.
which I think they put out in the early 2000s, 2003, something like that, 2004.
Right.
And I watched the video. I got on YouTube and watched the video of a guy driving one. I thought, wow, that's a great bike, you know. So I thought, well, I'm going to call the song that. And I dedicated it to my brother, Tom, because he's passed away now, but many years ago, he wanted to have a Harley-Davidson.
Right.
But he didn't really want to buy a brand new one. I think he wanted to kind of trick one out. So he bought a basket case. He bought one that was in boxes and baskets and barrels and everything else.
Really?
It took him a year or so to put it together.
Wow.
And he put it all together and tricked it out with a long front end and airbrushed gas tank and all that
mm-hmm.
stuff. And he rode it for, I don't know, 2-3 years all over the place and loved it to death. And then I think he finally sold it. So I thought, well, I'm going to dedicate this to him because I think he would like the track, you know.
Oh, that's incredible.
And because it was Soft Tail Deuce, I found some wonderful sound effects of Harley-Davidson and put them on the beginning of the song and the end of the song.
Great, great track. Love it.
Thank you, yeah.
Really do like it. The other side of the coin, Slow and Steady, Rock and Roll, blues, kind of a blues track. I love that as well. Another
that's
great
sort
song.
Of my tribute to Jimmy Reed.
To Jimmy Reed.
You know, I loved his, he could do, he had a corner on those slow shuffles. And,
love it.
Yeah, he was one of my heroes when I was learning blues and stuff, because I thought, man, how do they hold those shuffles so steady?
Mm-hmm.
And they just groove till they can just groove on them all night long. It's wonderful.
It's
so
neat.
That's
yeah.
sort of my tribute to Jimmy.
And then you end the album with Karen singing Happy Trails.
Yep.
Yep. I love it.
Yep.
Karen
well,
seems
I
great.
Thought, I thought, okay, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to make the album a bit of a journey. So you go through different kinds, you get different styles. You know, there's acoustic stuff. There's the song called Ice Storm, which is very trippy.
Right. Sure.
And there's all these different kinds of songs, and I thought, well, at the very end, I should have Karen saying "Happy Trails" to you, like Dale Evans and Roy Rogers used to do at the end of their TV show.
Yeah.
When I was a little kid, I used to love that. So it was—I tell you—it was difficult to come up with an arrangement, though, because I wanted to do it so much like the way they did it. But then, of course, you can't do that because they've already done that. So I was trying to figure like a sort of a campy arrangement or something. I went through about five or six different arrangements, and finally I was just kind of noodling around with different chords, some altered chords and stuff, and I had Karen come in and just sing it, and it just that was it. Okay, that's the way we got to do it. It's more poignant, and it's not quite so funny and campy, you know. It's sort of like, okay, guys, we'll see you later. The album's done.
Exactly.
We'll
that's exactly
yeah, that's
how it sounded.
Yeah.
Karen's got a great voice, by the way.
Yeah, she's got a terrific voice. She sang background with Gary Newman in the 80s and did a lot of sessions in London and stuff like that. So we've done some stuff together. One of the plans when we get to Spain is to work on some more stuff together.
Right. So you're going to have more vocal on the album? You think?
Well, what we would probably do is if we did something together, it would be vocals.
Right.
But I'm still really into being an instrumentalist. So if I do another solo album, it's going to be mostly instrumental. I mean, I still might have her sing on something, but she does. She did a little vocal thing on Bodhi Tree,
right,
in the beginning. So she did a lot of harmonies on Welcome to Manhattan Blues project. She did a lot of background singing, a lot of like chorally kind of singing. So she's been on albums before. So, you know, I'll continue to use her voice as an instrument. You know,
do you sing as well, Steve?
No. I do not sing. I have a horrible voice. I hate my voice.
You never know. You got to practice.
I heard my voice on and Swept Away, and I thought, nope, I'm not a singer. I should keep my mouth shut.
I talked to Robin Trower about that because he didn't sing for a long time, and now he's singing on all his albums, you know. And
yeah.
So.
Well, he's got more courage than I got. I don't like it. I can't stand hearing my voice.
Are you planning any kind of tour to promote the album? Any you know, short gigs or anything like that?
Well, no, not really. Part of the problem is my eyes.
Right.
It's difficult for me to play on stage. It's not impossible, but it's really difficult. And also, it's expensive to tour. I don't know if we can afford to go out and actually make any money or be able to pay musicians what they should be paid. You know, I just don't think it's feasible. If I had a bigger following, or if I had more of a draw, or if I had something like that, or if I could get attached to a tour or something, maybe. But it's just that it's really difficult to tour. I don't know how bands do it these days in particular. So
maybe you should do some smaller gigs and see how that goes, you know?
Well, I'm even talking about smaller gigs.
Yeah.
I'm even talking about that. Smaller gigs
really?
Are even worse because
there's
just less money, you know?
Yeah.
You go do a 100-seat club, you can't make any money. I mean, a promoter doesn't make any money. It's just I've been very discouraged by that plus my eyesight.
Yeah. It's a shame because you do have a great following.
Well, I love playing live.
You do have a good following.
I really hate it that I can't. You know, plus I'm getting older too, and touring is a lot harder on me now than it used to be.
Yeah,
2011 tour with Alice beat me up. And,
I know you've been on a lot of tours and played with a lot of bands already. So I can imagine.
Yeah,
but just remember, John Mayall's still touring, and he's in his 80s.
Well, Alice is still touring, and he's my
age. Right.
He tours every year, and I tell you what, he busts his butt. He's amazing. He just goes out there and throws it out there every night.
He is amazing.
I'm really proud of him for that, you know. I think that's really wonderful. I think had I toured steadily all through my career, I think I'd probably still be doing it too.
Right.
But there were times when I wasn't touring, you know, several years where I didn't tour. So.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of session work, you know, to be done still. You know, I know you and Tracy Chapman also.
Yeah.
You did a lot of things with her, and you know,
toured with her. Did a couple albums. Yeah.
You had fun touring with her, right?
I'm sorry?
You had fun touring with Tracy, right?
I tell you what, I enjoyed it. It was probably one of the best. Probably one of the best tours, only because her songs are just fabulous.
Mm-hmm.
Playing these great songs every night was just a real dream. And the other thing too is, it was a little bit of time off from just rock and roll and blues. It was more of a different, unique style of music, which was really good. I got to play several instruments. I got to play acoustic guitar, dobro, mm-hmm. mandolin. I played several instruments on stage, so it was really a wonderful, fun thing to do. I really enjoyed touring with her.
Do you still keep in contact with Tracy?
No.
Maybe future projects or anything?
No, you know, it's funny. I don't keep a track. We don't keep in touch. A lot of people don't, you know?
Yeah,
it's
I know.
It's not unusual. Every once in a while, I still get an email from, I still email Peter Gabriel, and we chat for a bit. And with Lou, I was the same thing. We just every once in a while, Alice, you know, we send messages back and forth. But it's not like, you know, you every day, let's go to dinner kind of thing or
right.
that sort of stuff. But we do keep it kind of loose touch.
Yeah. You know, I got to mention the Manhattan Blues Project. That was a great album. And you had great players on that. Tony Levin, who I've interviewed before, Joe Perry, Joe Satriani, of course, Michael Lee Perkins. Awesome album. And a couple of tracks, you know, you did a great job on What's Going On, Marvin Gaye's What's Going On. That was really cool.
That was tough to do, too. That was
I can imagine.
I loved the original version so much, I was afraid to touch it. Because the original version, to me, is like one of the best singles ever.
Mm-hmm.
It is. Everything about that single is perfect. And I was afraid to touch it. So I tried, I tried about four or five different versions. And finally, I just said, you know what? I'm going to slow it down, and I'm going to make it much bluesier and just do it my way.
Mm-hmm.
And then that arrangement finally came out, you know. But it sure took some effort. It was a tough one.
Yeah, it's tough when you got, you know, these, you know, legendary recordings and then you
want
to tackle it, you know.
It's really tough, yeah.
Especially people that you admire, you know, it's kind of,
And I've always admired that as like the epitome of production and everything, recording, everything.
Exactly. My favorite track on the album is 222 West 23rd.
Yeah, cool.
Is that the Hotel Chelsea? Is that the address of that?
I used to stay there a lot in the 70s.
Oh, is that what it is? I was wondering what the significance of that address was.
Oh, I stayed there. I loved that place. Absolutely loved it. I used to stay there all the time. I would request it, you know, when somebody called me up to go into New York for a few days. They'd say, where do you want to stay? And I always say Chelsea. Let me say Chelsea. Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's a great hotel.
And from Incredible, Swept Away, 8 Miles High is another, you know, interesting song that you tackled and did a fantastic job with.
That's another one of my favorite songs. You know, it's one of my favorite Birds tunes, you know. So I had to do some sort of version of that.
Well, you nailed it.
Thank you.
How's Jason Becker doing these days? You know?
Well, he's hanging in there pretty good. He's finishing up. He's got another album coming out, and it's a slow process with him, so it takes time to do it. But pieces I've heard sound stunning, so it's going to be a great record when it's done. But
he's
still working on that. You know?
Good.
Yeah.
Yeah. He's an incredible story. He really is.
Yeah.
Steve,
he's still a good friend of mine. We're still really good friends. Yeah.
Here's a question I ask everybody. If you had a Field of Dreams moment, a wish, like the movie, to perform, collaborate with anyone from the past or present, who would that be?
Oh, that's a tough one. Probably Jimi Hendrix.
Jimi Hendrix, yeah.
Yeah. Probably because I learned so much stuff from him. He started so many things on guitar that nobody else was doing at the time.
Right.
There were so many things I heard him do that I'd never heard any other guitar player do that I'd like to have a moment. I think a really close second will be Stevie Ray Vaughan.
Right.
But I would like to sit and for a couple hours and play with either one of those guys.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think that would be a wonderful moment for me. You know?
Hendrix was, you know, on the verge of doing so many different things, too, before he passed away.
Oh, yeah, I know. I'd heard that he was going to do something with Miles Davis.
Yeah, can you do that?
And yeah. All kinds of stuff, so.
Yeah. Yeah, he was awesome.
He really was, yeah.
He really was. So what's next for Steve Hunter? What's your future plans now after the new album? Great new album,
well,
5 stars.
It's a little tough to know that now because what's primarily on our mind is getting to Spain. So
okay.
That's taken up an enormous amount of our time. Obviously, we have to sell a house, and there's a lot of stuff we have to do yet.
Yeah.
So I hadn't really thought. I mean, I'm gonna keep recording for as long as I can.
I hope so.
The wonderful thing about recording and computers and stuff is that you can kind of still keep doing that. My eyes haven't completely gone yet, but
yeah,
you know, it's a pain in the butt. I got to use the Zoom a lot, you know, but it's okay. I can still work, and I don't mind that. I've gotten quite used to it. So, no, I'm going to continue making music for as long as I can. That's just what I do. You know, I don't want to ever stop doing that. Wonderful thing about being a musician is you don't have to retire if you don't want to.
That's right.
Chet Atkins on stage when he was 74 years old, mm-hmm. and he was still playing the most beautiful guitar ever. And,
yeah.
So, you know, and I also saw Segovia when he was 90.
Oh, wow.
He was ridiculous.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah. I keep thinking, well, okay, I don't have to retire. You know, it's up to me.
I hope not.
No. I'm going to keep playing until I can't play anymore.
You're going to learn so many things in Spain, too, you know, but by living there and hanging out with the local and the music scene there and all that, you're going to want to record and record.
Well, they have a wonderful form of music there called chill out, which
okay.
I absolutely love. It's mm-hmm. really, really wonderful stuff. There's an island there called Ibiza, and there's a place there called Cafe Del Mar,
mm-hmm.
and they have invented a genre of music because it's a restaurant, and they played this music. They got this music together to play at the restaurant that turned mm-hmm. into now it's a record label.
Really?
Kind of stuff. Yeah.
What does it sound like?
Well, it's really hard to describe because it's sort of like new age music in one sense, but it's a lot more hip. It's got mm-hmm. cooler drum beats and it's got cooler stuff going on. It's not. It's also kind of got a little bit of R&B in it. It's got a little bit of smooth jazz.
It sounds
but yet it's a little bit edgier than all those.
Hmm. What's it called again? I'm sorry.
There's several different genres along the same line. There's one called Chill Out.
Chill Out, okay.
And then there's another one called Lounge. It's called Lounge. There's French Lounge. There's Brazilian Lounge. They're these little subgenres from all around the world. It's one of those weird things where it hasn't hit America yet. You know, Karen turned me on to it. She asked me if I ever heard of Cafe Del Mar, and I said no. What's that? And she played a couple of tracks for me, and I fell in love with it. Mm. It's just like the coolest stuff. It's very trippy, kind of trippy, relaxing kind of music. So it's not rock and roll, but it's cool and hip. Without being boring, you know, there's like some really cool stuff in the production and in the mixing and in the arrangements. So, it is meant to be sort of relaxing kind of music without being boring. You know,
it's edgy.
Not like ambient. Yeah. Ambient music is more like just this wonderful sounds. You know,
right.
Cafe Del Mar type music or chill out has structure. The songs have structures. They usually have some sort of a beginning and middle and end and stuff. So it has a structure, but it's really kind of just cool beats, you know. And there's some that have vocals and some that don't. You know, it's very cool music. If you look it up on YouTube, you just type in chill out music and you'll hear all kinds of different examples of it. And there's tons of different little subgenres.
I'm going to look it up. I love world music.
I really like it, so, you know.
Yeah, I love world music. There's so much good stuff out there.
Yeah, it's like world music, yeah.
Yeah, so much good music out there. And, you know, I get so sick and tired of the mainstream radio, all that crap.
Oh, I do, too. I don't listen to it at all.
Yeah, it's terrible. It really is.
Yeah.
Steve, thank you so much, man, for being on the show today, and more importantly, for all the incredible music you've given us, and will continue to bring us in Spain.
I will for sure.
I hope so.
There might be a little more Spanish flavor to it. That's all.
That's fine. That's fine with me.
Okay.
Good luck on the move and everything, and the best of luck, and we'll keep in touch.
Yeah, please do. Thanks, Ray.
All right, Steve. Thank you, man. Take care.
Okay.
All right.
Bye.
Purchase Steve Hunter's Before the Lights Go Out at Amazon.com. For more information about Steve Hunter, visit www.stevehunter.com or Steve on Facebook, www.facebook.com/steve.hunter.54. Very special thanks to the great Billy James of Glass Onion PR for arranging this interview with Steve Hunter, and to Doug and Don Newsom with BBS Radio for making it all happen every show. Join me bi-weekly Mondays at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on The Ray Shasho Show. If you have comments or suggestions or would like to be a guest on The Ray Shasho Show, call 941-877-1552 or email us at raypublicityworksagency.com. And don't forget to purchase a copy of my book entitled Check the G's, The True Story of an Eclectic American Family and Their Wacky Family Business, or the second edition, entitled Wacky Shenanigans on F Street, Proud to Be Politically Incorrect, in Washington, D.C., available now at Amazon.com. I promise you will live it. Have a great week, everybody.
Thank you, everybody, for listening to The Ray Shasho Show, brought to you by the Publicity Works Agency. Call 941-877-1552 or visit us at publicityworksagency.com, specializing in author and music artist publicity plans. We shine when we make you shine. Join Ray Shasho every Monday at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern on BBS Radio Station 1.